This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello there, good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Sharad Kutan here with me. Hello, Sharad Kutan.
Hello, Melissa Idris. Was it a good weekend for you?
It was a great weekend. Basically, not doing anything is always a good weekend.
Yeah,
right?
Rest. Yeah. I think, you know, people underestimate the value of rest. I speak to a lot of Grab car drivers, Uber drivers, whatever it is. And a lot of them are people doing it part-time. And I often say to them, well, you know, don't you feel the need for rest? And it often gets translated into this, you know, like, oh yeah, I do spend some time with my family and my friends, but then I get very bored. So I might as well make some money instead of sitting home being bored. And so the idea of rest itself is perhaps...
Really? I treasure...
Something that we don't share.
I treasure my... So I've split my weekend to at least having one day full rest. So Saturdays are spent usually not doing much because, you know, Sunday you've got work to prepare for the next week and chores and household stuff that you want to... errands you need to run. So it's, Saturday is usually my day of rest and my me time. And I really do appreciate that.
Yeah. And I wonder what happens because we don't share or there isn't a common sense of or a consensus on what rest means.
Mm.
You know, for some people, rest could be extremely boring because for them, doing nothing, as it were, which I'm assuming is what happens with you on a Saturday,
yes.
Is extremely unrestful because people get restless.
Restless. Oh, very
doing
nice.
Nothing. And but I wonder if that actually isn't good for people, that, you know, maybe it's got my particular point of view, which I think is the point of view I share with you, really,
yeah.
Is that doing nothing is actually very healthy.
It is. Alone time is great. Really, downtime, switching off. I love all that. We get so little of that nowadays, but it's good. But now we're, you know, starting the week, getting plugged in, and we're going to kick off the week for you with a great show today. 4 hours of awesomeness, as they say. On the breakfast grill today, Hans Asadi, the managing director of Heineken Malaysia, will be on the show. Heineken Malaysia recently changed their name. So they were previously known as Guinness Anchor Berhad, GAB. So the name change was just approved by shareholders at an EGM last week. So I'm going to be focusing on three areas with Hans on the breakfast grill: tax, price increases, and contraband product. So these three areas, definitely the reason why Heineken Malaysia is in the news at the moment.
Yeah, we often refer to industries like this as part of that group of, activities, business activities that we consider sinful, mm-hmm. well, at least in terms of how the taxation system works. And I think some of us have argued on air that maybe sin is not the right word. It should be something like habits and maybe bad habits, if you like, if you consider some of these things bad habits. But the
vices,
end of the day,
maybe, vices.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But the end of the day, you know, it's about our individual pleasures. And whether in this country, at least, we all have a right to our pleasures, especially when they have no effect, no direct effect on larger society. I mean, it's essentially what you do for yourself, right? And I do think that we still have a problem on that score, just because some people don't respect the right of others to have their pleasures. They want to dictate what pleasures other people have.
Yeah, and I wonder whether this the businesses in this sector have been unfairly penalized by authorities. So I'll speak to Hans Asadi, what he thinks. Clearly, I mean, you know, you have to take it with a pinch of salt. He is in the sector itself, but he does make some fair arguments in terms of whether this is going to be the tipping point for breweries in general. I mean, they've come under a lot of pressure recently. So I'd like to know what he thinks when it comes to, for instance, the new duty structure that the government has implemented, which came as quite a surprise to the breweries.
Yeah, I think he's there to put the position of those in that industry, you know, I think you can, in fact, it's not that you take it a pinch of salt, but you have to take it at face value. Yeah, he is, in fact.
And you have to challenge that, right? You have to challenge those assumptions that he's making.
And he's, you know, he's making an argument for, you know, the industry that he represents. But also, I think perhaps for larger society or that segment of society that would like to have choice.
For sure. That's on The Breakfast Grill today. We will be speaking to Hans Asadi, the Managing Director of Heineken Malaysia, previously known as Guinness Anchor Berhad. After the grill on current affairs, we zoom in on Sarawak because today is nomination day for the 11th state elections there. It starts at 9 a.m. And all 82 state seats are expected to be contested.
Yeah, we have, of course, had an increase in the number of state seats as a result of an exercise by the Elections Commission to redraw some boundaries. And there was it was contentious, but I think the courts found in favour of the Election Commission. And so these are the new boundaries that Sarawakians have to, as it were, play this particular game on. A lot of is riding on this. I mean, in part, Melissa, you know, the polls suggest that Sarawakians are very happy with the leadership of Adnan Saadim, the successor to the long-ruling Taib Mahmud administration.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is whether it will translate for all of Barisan Nasional and its component parties in this contest. And what is it? Does it mean for the relationship between Sarawak and the Federation as a whole? So, as you know, that you know Adnan Saadim is doing several things. He's pushing for support for Barisan Nasional, which means not just at the state level but also federally. But at the same time, he's pushing for state rights and that agenda. So mm-hmm. he's leapt onto a bandwagon that almost every, I think, party in Sarawak is also on, which is increased autonomy, more control over resources, and in fact, I think a redistribution of resources back to Sarawak. Sarawak is an extraordinarily wealthy state.
State, yeah, lots of resources,
and,
of course.
And, you know, so they want to have more, they want a fair share, as they see it, of those resources.
Do you, so we're going to be speaking to Dato' Peter Moniz, who is a prominent Bidayuh politician and also a senior member of the Parti Pesaka Bumiputra Bersatu, one of the linchpin parties for Barisan Nasional.
It is the biggest party in the Barisan Nasional Coalition. It's, of course, Taib Mahmud's party. It's the party Adnan Saadim. And
any surprises, you reckon, that we're expecting? I mean,
well, I
nomination
think
day is today and polling is on the 7th, if I'm not mistaken.
The on both sides of the aisle, there's been a bit of trouble. Adnan Saadim had issues with candidates, and there are a lot more so-called direct candidates than they were before. And this is because some of the component parties in the Barisan Nasional, like SUPP, split. And so you have, you know, competition between the two factions, as it were. And he had to walk a tightrope with regard to that. On the other side of the aisle, we have DAP and PKR competing over certain constituencies. And I think, unfortunately, they haven't been able to come to a decision, at least from the last report I read. And so so that's not been very good for the opposition at the state level. And I'm not quite sure how it affects relationships within those coalition partners in various states, including Selangor and Penang, where they are the governing party coalition. So interesting to see how, you know, partners deal with it. But this is real politics, you know, and as you see, it's on both sides.
Yeah.
Both sides of the aisle have similar problems because elections are a competitive business.
Well, we'll be speaking more on the Sarawak state elections at 8:35 a.m. on Current Affairs today. Also happening on the show, Pressing Matters. That's where we look at, we go behind the headlines and talk to people, members of the press, about the stories that they're covering. Today we speak to Joyce Goh from The Edge Media Group. And The Edge has recently had a slew of scoops on the banking sector. So we're going to get the story from Joyce. That's at 9:35 a.m. today. It's 10 minutes past 6. Let's take a quick look at the news from the weekend. All you need to know as you start your week on Saturday, the founder of the Sky Kingdom cult passed away, Ayah Pin. He passed away at the age of 74 at his home in Besut, Terengganu.
Yeah, I personally, as somebody who studied anthropology, I'm very loath to use the word cult.
Me too.
Because cult is a word that we use to describe a religion that we don't, or a belief system we don't give legitimacy to.
Well, he's been deemed deviant by the religious authorities of the country, and that's how I think most of the news reports have framed him. But he's a fascinating figure for me personally. I think there's such a story here. I mean, how is it that this man has reached almost, you know, an iconic status with the teapots and the big umbrella. Do you remember his commune or his compound with the photos of that giant teapot?
Yeah, and you know, I think there was quite a bit of perhaps derision poured and scorn poured on belief systems like this. If you reach back into your old stack of Off the Edge magazines produced by The Edge, you will actually, there's a long piece on the, you know, the commune, as you put it. I think
by Edin Koo, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think it was by Edin. I think also subsequently the attempt to suppress it, for those of us who, if you read the details, Melissa, you'd be quite surprised, because the charge sheet reads like a charge sheet for, or a checklist for ecumenism. You know, basically, a very open and somewhat generous worldview. For a whole host of reasons, he got into trouble for that. But I think the question is whether, you know, minority groups, and I think the Ayah Pin believers constitute a minority group, whether minorities can have their place under the Malaysian sun, or are we a country that will not give space for that?
Well, speaking of Terengganu, since Ayah Pin was based there, Terengganu Menteri Besar is also in the news, Datuk Seri Ahmad Razif Abdul Rahman. He has declined to comment on speculation about the withdrawal of his salutations, his state awards. So the Datuk Seri that's been conferred on him from the palace. So at a couple of functions over the weekend, the MC only referred to him by his first name as Menteri Besar without mentioning those salutations. So rumours are rife that he had those awards have been revoked.
Yeah, so without the title, he still has the right to be the Menteri Besar. The question, of course, is what happens when in the real politic that we have, when the state government is at loggerheads with or doesn't find favour with the palace, right? Mm-hmm. To the extent that, I mean, not all states in Malaysia have a palace. You know, the royal houses are in nine of our states, right? Not all of them. And so the question is, should it matter? Does it matter? And how it's going to be viewed by the party? So the party, the ruling party, I guess, will have to negotiate. The question is, if the palace is unhappy, what does the palace want? And does what the palace want, is it legitimate and within the constitution? And then how does that affect the legitimacy of a duly elected government?
And is it some form of punishment? I mean, you know, I would want to know what he's done. If it is in fact true what he has done, or what the palace has deemed him to have done.
Yeah, I think I think the constitution demands is that the palace remain above politics, right? And that's very clear, undisputable. But the question is, what actually happens, and to what extent the palace chooses to weigh in on state politics.
Well, speaking of royals, TMJ, or Tengku Mahkota of Johor, Tengku Ismail Ibrahim, yesterday he denied that he was buying the Italian foot club AC Milan. Football club. So he said, apparently it was reported by a Singapore newspaper that he was interested to buy the club, but then he came out to say, look, it was it was merely him expressing a dream and that he does not have the money to do so. But, you know, with TMJ, you know, everyone loves a good story about him.
Yeah, but, you know, and of course, it's not within the realm, it's not outside the realm of possibility. Yeah. He's I think, one of the richest, he's in the top 10 richest wow. under 30-year-olds, I believe, or is it under 35-year-olds? He's a businessman in his own right, as his father is. And then the question is, of course, how much would AC Milan cost? And I don't know if you could Google it. How much would it cost to buy AC Milan?
Whether we can afford it, whether he can afford it, we don't know. But we'll get back to you on the price of AC Milan. More conversation after this on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. This is The Morning Run with Melissa and Sherrod. It's now 6:21 a.m. Good morning. Now, we were looking at this article from the New York Times about a growing number of fashion brands offering Islamic or modest collections. Now, it seems to have started about 3 years ago when Marks and Spencer's introduced the burkini, which is the full-body swimsuit, which consists of a long-sleeved tunic with hood and matching trousers. So in 2014, DKNY created a Ramadan collection that was followed the next year by similar ventures from Tommy Hilfiger and Uniqlo. And in January this year, Dolce & Gabbana introduced a hijab and abaya line. So this has somehow sparked debate in the West about whether Islamic fashion is in fact in line with what the fashion brands are doing.
Yeah. A very important question, but before we asked the question before we went
to
the
break.
Oh, yes,
that's right.
And the question was,
AC Milan, how much does it cost?
775 million USD, which is about 3 billion ringgit.
775.
Okay. Well, I've tweeted out the link to that number, and I've also asked the question whether you think we should just buy a successful team and give up building one. And
oh,
so,
my.
Yeah. And, you know, so we could have Harimau Milan. You know, just rename the whole thing. Why? Just buy it.
Just buy it and change the sticker on top. Okay.
And I wouldn't dismiss the question, should we just buy success? It happens around the world.
It's called mergers and acquisitions, Sherrod. Okay. Well, going back to Islamic fashion.
Well, okay. So this is clearly something that would be controversial in a context in which such clothing are seen as unusual, perhaps representing a whole range of communities, as well as values that Europeans some Europeans either fear and others look at as somewhat exotic. So whatever it is, in many ways, it seems like a European debate.
Yeah.
But I think even locally, we do have issues with regard to fashion and what it represents, you know, whether it's modesty or piety or freedom and individuality, all of which seem to generate quite a bit of passions. They stir passions. So on Twitter this morning, we were sharing a bit of a giggle over, you know, men's fashion. There was a recent, I think, show. I don't know if it's recent. It was very hard to
determine
the
origins of this story.
I do remember, though, you know, it was Baju Melayu, but really hipster, and a lot of the fashion shows seemed to have, you know, the men only kind of half clad, so, you know, their torso is visible and all that. And, you know, and because there's a lot of jokes, I mean, the images went around. Somebody even photoshopped an image saying, well, and put more clothes onto the models.
Okay, I have to, okay, backtrack here for a minute. So this was a fashion show trying to promote or model Baju Melayu, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes,
right? Okay, and it was of topless models with only the bottom half of the Baju Melayu being modelled. Okay, all right.
Yeah, well, you know, people can joke about it and say, well, you know, they didn't have enough money because at 300 or 400 ringgit a pop for the set,
wow,
this was, you know, so too expensive for the individual buy.
But afford the bottom half.
But, you know, if it's high fashion, 400 ringgit is nothing, right?
Oh, true.
So why is it that we demand that local designs be cheap? I mean, we can't maintain, you know, fashion mm-hmm. industry if we have different rules. So when it comes to your foreign brands, you're quite willing to pay 400 ringgit for, you know, a handkerchief. But as soon as it's some local design, a Malaysian fashion, then it should be 4 ringgit for, you know, three sets plus plus or whatever, you know. I mean, it just, it doesn't seem fair. But anyway, going back to the issue, we're going to tweet out some of the links here.
Well, it's somewhat similar, don't you think, the issue, the article from the New York Times talking about Islamic fashion plus and what you mentioned this morning, because what is fashion if not to push boundaries of, you know, to transform the person wearing it? And we should be, you know, be open to fashion evolving in certain ways. If Dolce & Gabbana want to have a buyer line, and if that's their business, if that they feel, you know, they want to push the boundaries of what an abaya is, so be it, right?
Yeah, you know, I believe, you know, a couple of years ago during the administration of Abdullah Ahmad Badawi, there was an attempt to revive the kabaya and all that the kabaya stood for, right, and stands for. And all the time,
what does the kabaya stand for to you?
Well, it's an interesting mix of, I think, the traditional and the modern. It accentuates a particular kind of Asian body, you know, lots of curves and a lot of value placed on voluptuousness, a fullness in the body.
And a tiny waist.
Tiny-ish. Comparison, mm-hmm. right? So the idea is to create and accentuate those curves, right. You know, kind of celebrate women, not, very unlike Twiggy or, you know, the kind of, you know, hipless, boy-like bodies
sort of
that mm-hmm. became fashionable in the 80s and such. But, you know, so I think what's very interesting about the kabaya, and also because the kabaya leaves a lot, well, doesn't leave much to the imagination for some people, right? It exposes so much. And so again, there, you know, a woman's ability to project her own body and to revel in its own shape and all that. So there is that. Really, that for me is what's interesting, because it's both traditional, but it also embraces the individual, right. And is, you know, gives space for the individual to project themselves. And I was recently at a performance called Kabaya Jazz, and the singer, you know, really made a point to talk about the politics of kabaya. And in the audience, and this was no black tie in KL, was a young woman, very fashionable, in a hijab. And in a very kind of fashionable hijabi kind of hipster outfit. And so it was interesting because you had two women very, very contrasting in their outlook and in terms of fashion, but also occupying the same space, you know. And for me, there's a wonderful politics around that. The idea is, of course, can we all coexist? Again, right. coming back to Aya Pin, and the question is whether we can accept difference in this country, or are we going to all be, you know, set to march to the same tune?
Well, you know, just going on the kabaya note, I had a conversation with someone many years ago, and the conversation lingered with me, and he was explaining the origins of the baju kurung. And if you think about the baju kurung, it sounds very restrictive. You know, we have that connotation that it's fully covered. But the idea of the baju kurung initially was to protect modesty, to kurung the modesty. And that just lingered with me, because many years I you know, he helps me look at the baju kurung in a different way.
Well, you know, traditional, I mean, if you look at some of the in ancient, you know, older images of Southeast Asia, a lot of women were topless. I mean, you know, and even my grandmother, okay, or my great grandmother, when I see pictures of her taken from the early part of the 20th century, she didn't wear a blouse. So she had a sari-like thing over her, but she didn't wear a blouse. And, you know, there are all kinds of permutations, right? And were these, you know, overtly sexual? Maybe they were. Maybe they're just part of the way in which people saw themselves and their societies allowed them to. Again, it's the question is, are we marching towards increased diversity and a respect for that diversity, or are we just marching in one or another direction and being suspicious of others? So in the story, I think about the abaya in the West is that there's a tremendous amount of suspicion, right?
Yes.
And so Western liberals, who ought to be celebrating diversity, are putting a question mark against the practice of including this diversity. one which maybe promotes modesty in this particular line. So I think it's a fascinating challenge for liberals. Liberals are always going to be in a conundrum because unlike the certainties of conservatives, liberals have to deal with difficult questions.
6:30 now, and time for the news bulletin on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Sharad Kutan here with me. It's now 6:41 a.m. on Monday, the 25th of April.
Well, Triffids, you know. I know people might not actually remember this. There was a novel called The Day of the Triffids. And Triffids are a fictitious kind of venomous plant. And
it's a plant.
And the
plant, you told me it was a monster.
Yeah, it's a monster plant. It's a kind of evil plant.
Okay, let's leave it at that. On a more somber note, with the passing of Prince last week, we really saw an outpouring of public grief around the world on social media. I don't know whether your social media feed was flooded with condolences for Prince and his families. But, you know, there's also been the other side of that public grief, the skeptics among us who have dismissed this outpouring of public grief as mass hysteria. The SNI terms for it is called mourning sickness, as in mourning, as in when you mourn someone, describing a supposedly ostentatious group grieving.
Also, or grief porn, I think.
Grief porn is...
which is a reference to how the media deals with it, right?
Yep, so getting the grief or condolences from other celebrities around the world. A collective angst is how they call it.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you remember when Princess Diana of Britain died.
Of course I do.
You remember? You must have been like a child in arms. I mean,
1997, wasn't it? Was it 1994?
No,
I was in high school, and I remember. That memory was quite vivid because of the blanket coverage of the funeral. I remember sitting on the sofa with my mother watching it, and my mother just overcome with emotion, just bawling her eyes out.
Okay, so had your mother met Princess, had she met Di? Did she know her personally?
That boils down to the question that we are asking this morning, right?
And you're right, it's 1997. 31st of August. Oh, Malaya Day.
So the question we're asking is, can you mourn someone you've never met? And just to go on the Princess Diana story with my mother, she was in the UK during Princess Diana's wedding. And she had also gotten her first baby when Princess Diana gave birth to Prince William. So she felt very much, you know...
she felt a
connection with Princess Diana. Yeah. And I think we all kind of watched Princess Diana as the face of the, I don't know, what do you call that? Trapped princess, you know, the gilded cage.
Okay, so I think, so this is the interesting media narrative. And it's, of course, all about the media, right? And how the media makes celebrities part of our lives and help us feel a personal connection. Because the kind of narrative that was spun around Diana and that perhaps Diana contributed to in spinning herself was that of a princess trapped within these awful structures. And so she was the victim and she played that to the hilt, right? And I mean, whether it was sincere or not, I'm not going to, speculate. But I don't think it's important. The important thing is that's the narrative and people fit themselves into it. So and so when she died, of course, then they felt an almost personal loss.
Okay, so what do you think, Sharad? Can you mourn someone that you've the death of someone that you've never met?
Clearly, you can.
You were very affected.
Should you or not? I don't know, but certainly you can.
Okay, so you were very affected by Prince's passing.
Well, I mean, much less so than I was when I gave away my cats. I mean, I must say.
So that's the thing, right? So I mean, for me, I've never felt that. I've never felt the passing of a celebrity so deeply that it shook me to the core.
Well, no, okay. Again,
to the core.
I wasn't shaken to the core by Prince's death.
You shed a tear.
I did shed. I mean, it was a tear. You know, I bawled my eyes out for my cats and, you know, my friend who passed away, you know, 2 days after that. But, you know, but for Prince, I mean, you know, it was a sense of a passing of a time. So you can, for someone like me who's very close in age to Prince, because much less successful or talented, but you know, I mean, I must say, it does make you feel there's a little twinge in you when you think of that somebody your age has passed, and all that you might be part of a generation that is passing away. So some of it is kind of indulgent. But I do think for us who live in this, you know, media-saturated world, it is quite thinkable and quite believable that people feel personal pain when celebrities die. I don't think it's... I wouldn't even pour scorn on people like that. I wouldn't say, oh, you know, you're so dumb, or what's wrong with you? Why are you feeling this way? I do feel
okay,
that
but
people
to,
do feel
to
that.
Be, okay, to be skeptical about it, have you not seen your social media feed being flooded by posts about Prince and his life and legacy, and, you know, people, the outpouring of grief? And I sometimes question whether that was in fact genuine. And I know it's not my place to question, because, you know, people deal with grief in different ways. But again, we're seeing this more and more because it's so publicly covered in the media.
I don't think you can... And of course, we do question the sincerity of people. But I think that's the wrong question to ask. I think what we do need to recognize is that there are all kinds of reasons why we're pulled into this. I mean, you know, I'm constantly watching movies or and understand how it is to be manipulated. You know, if you watch the recent Coen Brothers movie, Hail Caesar. Which is extraordinary, because at the end of the movie, the character page by George Clooney, this rather dumb blonde, as it were, of a man, he gives a stirring speech, and everybody is kind of caught in the moment. And if you're not careful, you too get caught up in the emotions that are stirred, right? It's the music, it's the pacing, it's the words that are used. But you know you're being manipulated, and the Coen brothers tell you you're being manipulated. Uh-huh. And yet, we get manipulated, right? And this is why mass politics is the way it is, because, you know, there are structures in our brains, and the way the media works allows us to be manipulated constantly around issues of race and religion and whatever.
Well, since we brought up the subject of celebrity deaths, I'd also like to point out that yesterday was believed to be the 400th anniversary of the death of William Shakespeare. Can we label him also a celebrity and a celebrity death?
Well, I think no, partly because he lived at a time when even now people question the real identity of Shakespeare. Well, the question is surrounding the authorship of the plays, right? So was it William Shakespeare? Was it Marlowe? Was it, you know, X, Y, and Z, who are often said to be the true authors of those plays? William Shakespeare might have been the historical character associated with the theatre and stuff, but was he the author? So, and I think not enough of it, you know, it doesn't have all the raw material to create kind of Lady Diana type figure.
Okay, and yet everybody knows who Shakespeare is.
Yes, because the Brits, you know, conquered much of the world. And through colonialism, they set up what they felt was the canon. I mean, you had to know this. And they have been very successful in promoting and marketing William Shakespeare as not only quintessentially British, but important to the human experience in literary form. And I think they're right. I mean, I think, over the weekend I watched a play, Shakespeare Demystified. One of our own people, Lim Soon Heng, a producer here, was acting in it. And a lot of questions to be asked about how do you bring Shakespeare to a Malaysian audience? I think their strategy was interesting. I don't agree with it necessarily. But the thing about Shakespeare is it has such an emotional complexity and such a love and feeling for the English language as it was then, that it's unsurpassed and unrivaled. And I think for that reason, I buy into the tagline that, you know, that, you know, Shakespeare's for all times and for all climes.
I see. Word. Well, 6:50 right now, and we've got Love You Madly by Cake after this on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.